You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the mysteries. The very highest degrees of which combined together make up a secret order known as the Illuminati. Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Sergei Fedorov, another of the Salisbury murderers, unmasked. Or is he? Somebody called Elliot Higgins seems to be standing up on our TV screens where Julian Assange used to do, as the world's most radical crowdsourced investigative journalist. But is Bellingcat really Britain's answer to WikiLeaks? And by the way, whatever happened to Julian Assange? He was cut off from the internet, wasn't he? In the land of the free. Plus the assassination of the leader of the Donbass. That's a breakaway part of Ukraine. And they broke away from Kiev back in 2014. Is the evil eye of Western power moving north? Could we see a flare-up in the east of Ukraine? On the Russian border? Imagine if the Ukrainian president had been assassinated. We'd be hearing a lot more about that, wouldn't we? And US Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, surprise resignation this week with no explanation. We try and figure out why. Journalists from Saudi Arabia living in the United States, Khashoggi, will the Saudis be able to get away with murdering him? Plus, Martin Summers will take us on to some of the world's hotspots the mass media turn a blind eye to, won't you, Martin? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon Tuesday. You can download it online now, though, at dialectradio.co.uk if you like. This week, crop circles explained and debunked, as well as a full interview with Fran Mayer over her disabled benefits being cut, you heard just now. Also, Concrete Soldiers, a new film out about the destruction of social housing under the guise of regeneration, digging right into that one. Listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, this whole business with Bellingcat this week, we've heard another person has been revealed, Sergei Fedorov. Fedorov. He's, Elliot Higgins has said that is the real name of one of the Salisbury poisoners.
Well, I've heard what he said, and I'm still waiting to analyse everything that they've presented. But, of course, the person he brought out last time, Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, just did a simple test of facial recognition of the guy he said that he was, and it came up negative, which any journalist could have done, but they didn't do it. Bellingcat, apparently, has become an expert on everything. Far better, far more than people like us, you see, Tony. All he's got is social media like we've got, but when he comes out with something, all of the mainstream media pick up on it immediately and say, oh, well, Bellingcat has saying this, this and the other. Extraordinary, really, because it just means they don't have to check it, and it then gets circulated around as if it's definitely the case, when in actual fact, it's not necessarily the case, and we're being bamboozled.
Well, the British Police and the Foreign Office, their statements, which are hardly even mentioned by the mainstream press, the London media, are saying that there is no conclusive or definitive evidence. They say we are not going to comment or speculation about their identities.
Well, indeed, and one of the things the BBC did, as Craig Murray pointed out on his blog, is they put up two pictures of Borisov and said that they were the same person. Well, of course they're the same person, because they're both Borisov, and the picture of Chipiga, or whatever his name was, wasn't even there. And of course, if you actually look at the pictures, they don't look the same, and when you do a facial recognition thing, they're not the same. So in actual fact, his previous comments about this have turned out to be completely wrong, not to mention all sorts of other things he's got wrong in the past about MH17 and so on. And in actual
fact, what has he got wrong about MH17?
Well, what he said is he put stuff up about how this was a video of a Buk missile being moved into the Ukraine, and he said he identified where it was and what was going on, and it turned out it was a completely different place, and he'd got it wrong. Now, in other words, this guy was basically somebody who used to sell underwear and was made redundant, and then sat on his computer at home and became an expert in all the weaponry that was being used in Syria. How long do you think it would take to become an expert in weaponry in Syria, having being an underwear salesman? Didn't take him long. Within 6 months, he'd become the world's expert on all the different weaponry being used in
so
Syria.
So who better to ask that question to than Elliot Higgins himself? So let's have a listen now to what he had to say. Well, the obvious question to ask, as they did on the BBC's World at One on Tuesday, how did you find out that this was his name, that the name of the guy was actually Sergei Fedorov?
Elliot Higgins, can you talk us through how you went about finding out who this man was?
So a big part of it was the fact that when he actually created this false persona, he actually used part of his actual real persona to do that. Using those pieces of information and past experience with other false GRU personas, we were able to establish who the identity was by combining various online databases with pieces of information there and pieces of information there, where we were able to actually piece together exactly who it was, who was his real identity. What we discovered is there's a lot of basically leaked databases online from Russia that have been around for years, in some cases decades, that were leaked with details like addresses, car registrations, all these little pieces of information. In a way, it creates a network of information. If you start exploring that network of information by finding dates of births and names and cross-referencing them, you start narrowing down the people it could be. And what that actually led to is just one name, one person, one date of birth, and we were able to actually get our hands on his identity documents, which had his photograph, which confirmed who it was.
Well, that's what he's saying. Why haven't MI6 done that, and why haven't the police done that? Why is it left to Elliot Higgins, who's supposedly an independent? He must be making a living from doing this. And what the suspicion is about him is he's basically a front person for the Western intelligence services. That's certainly how he's seen in the rest of the world.
What sense does it make to have someone as a cutout like him?
Because it means that they can spread basically disinformation without having to take responsibility for it. In fact, Gavin Williams waded in on the first identification of Borisov as Chipiga, and then he had to delete the tweet because he was told by the intelligence services and others, oh no, we can't actually do this because we haven't actually had anybody can check that it's not the same person by carrying out a basic facial recognition check, which you can do with software you can download, and nobody had done it. And at that point they said no, shush. So what they're actually doing is they're spreading rumours which support the government's line, but without the government having to put itself on the line and say that's what we think, which could actually be disproved, which would show that they were lying
anyway.
So Elliot Higgins can be shown to be lying, but it means that the MI6, who are probably feeding him the information, are not shown to be lying, so he's a cutout.
Anyway, the BBC, bless them, started to drill down. They were really cross-examining him really toughly on Tuesday, and so here they start to ask him even more questions about how did you find it out?
Following our previous investigations, we published a lot of information that resulted in people reaching out to us, making suggestions about who it could be. Some people claimed they knew the person. Some people, unfortunately, weren't telling the truth, so those were dead ends. Whenever we're sent information, we cross-reference it with information we already have. We do more open-source investigation to see if we can confirm it. Following the earlier publication, we had lots of people sending us photographs they found on social media saying, is this the person? And, we would look at things simple as looking at features on their face. So in this current example with Mishkin, he's actually got two very distinct blemishes on his face that are visible in all of his ID documents. His ear shape as well, he's got kind of a bit of ear that, his ear that pokes out on the left side of his head that is also very distinct and visible in all these photographs. So when people send us photographs, we're looking for those kind of features. Plus, we then, if it looks like he has them, we start searching for other information as well to further confirm that.
Well, interesting enough, Craig Murray pointed out that Elliot Higgins, Bellingcat, said that when the white helmets, the so-called Syrian civil defence, were being identified as jihadis, he said that you can't identify people from basic video footage like that. It's unfair. So in that case, it's unfair. In this case, it isn't. Do you know what I suspect here? Bellingcat, Elliot Higgins, works with Western intelligence services. They feed him stuff and they say to him, push it out there, because we don't want to push it out there because it can't stand up, but you can push it out there and everybody can follow it. Now, the first identification has definitely been proved to be wrong with basic software that anybody can download. Now, I haven't had time this week to look at what's wrong with this, but in actual fact, if somebody is shown to be basically a false witness or an unreliable witness in one case, you don't actually take notice of them in case two.
He's got the same shaped ears.
Well, I'll have to see what Craig Murray says about this, because we can do a quite straightforward test on this, whether it's the same person or not.
Can't you think for yourself? Do you just have to copy what Craig Murray tells you?
No, I don't have to copy what Craig Murray tells me. But Craig Murray, of course, speaks fluent Russian, unlike Elliot Higgins, who's basically an underwear salesman and doesn't speak any Russian at all. And therefore, he says he's gone through all this Russian documentation. How so, since he doesn't speak Russian?
Can I just correct something we said? It's not Sergei Fedotov who was the one who was revealed on Tuesday. It was actually Alexander Mishkin and Anatoly Chepiga the previous week, of the two guys apparently that came to Salisbury. This guy, Sergei Fedotov, has been announced today by the Russian website Fontanka.ru. It says a GRU military intelligence operative whose name is Sergei Fedotov is allegedly the third Russian agent involved in trying to kill former spy Sergei Skripal in Britain earlier this year. So anyway, let's have a listen to the final clip from the BBC on Tuesday, where the BBC, again doing their job, ask Elliot Higgins, who runs the Bellingcat website, don't you ever get accused of just being a cutout for MI6?
We've had an awful lot of accusations made about us. I think I've been accused of being part of every single spy agency on the planet. I'd obviously be very well paid if that was the case, and I think anyone who can see my suit today can say that that's not true. But the main thing with us is we're very transparent about the way we go about our work. If you look at the article we've written today about Mishkin, you can see how we've gone through step by step explaining the process we went through. It's quite unusual for us because we did use closed source evidence in this investigation, but we've been very clear about where we've done that and why we had to do that.
And are you, as a result of this investigation or any other, afraid for your own safety?
Well, we've done a large amount of investigations covering MH17. I mean, with MH17 in particular, we really show that Russia was repeatedly lying about what happened.
This was the plane that was down, the Malaysian Airlines plane.
This, right. And Russia repeatedly lied. They presented fake evidence. They've deceived. I think we're already on their radar, but I think certainly this has made us a brighter dot on that radar.
And are you aware of attempts to access your computer systems because of this?
We've actually been in 2015, we were actually part of the large hacking campaign by Fancy Bear, which was revealed to be the GRU, that was also targeting people like the DNC, the Podesta email leaks. And in 2017, we also had a massive campaign against us of phishing attacks, again from the same people. So it appears the GRU has repeatedly attempted to access our emails. Fortunately, they failed.
Well, you mentioned the DNC there. All the evidence suggests that the emails from the DNC, which showed that the primaries were rigged in the US presidential election, were a leak, not a hack, a leak that went to WikiLeaks via Craig Murray, the former Russian British ambassador in Uzbekistan, to Julian Assange inside the Ecuadorian embassy. And they have been putting their hands up all along, said, we know where this comes from, and it wasn't from the Russians. Therefore, there he's saying, and we know the GRU did, they hacked the DNC emails. We don't know any such thing, Elliot. Anybody who's serious about this knows that the DNC emails weren't hacked. They were leaked. And that's what just shows that you're not actually carrying out any serious research at all.
So the long and short of this, Martin, is that we're being sort of led along here, aren't we? A lot of the original problems with this story, for example, it doesn't look as if it was Novichok that was used on the Skripals, otherwise they'd be dead, and probably hundreds more people in Salisbury would have been dead. Also, there was an unnamed off-duty doctor and nurse who both treated Sergei Skripal and Julia on the bench as they were foaming at the mouth and raving, apparently, and they opened their airways. They were the first on the scene, but they suffered no ill effects at all.
No, and if it was Novichok, they'd be dead, all of them. So there's a fundamental problem with all of this. Now, you've got to, what our listeners have got to understand is that the Western intelligence services engage in psychological warfare. And they engage in psychological warfare in the Maidan Square, where over 80 people were shot dead, including police officers.
How come the whole of
but
the
it
Western...
wasn't carried out by the Yanukovych regime.
How
there's a court
the
case in Kiev that points the
yes,
finger firmly
how
in
come,
the opposite direction.
How come the whole of the London media is supine here and not really asking questions like we are today?
Elliot Higgins claims that his bank account, that he's an independent person, blah and blah, but we do most of what we do for nothing, Tony. I'll bet you somebody's paying him, somebody's making sure he's all right.
Also, back in March, there was a detective constable who said he was taken ill with Novichok poisoning, but unlike the doctor and the nurse, he didn't even touch them.
Well, indeed, and he's also all disappeared. He's resigned from the police and he's disappeared, supposedly to protect him from the Russians. But it means that nobody can talk to him because it doesn't make sense at all. When was he exposed to Novichok? By going to he was a detective inspector, a detective sergeant as well, or something like that. He wouldn't have been on the beat.
He was a detective constable, I think.
Yeah, so in other words, he wouldn't have been on the beat. Yeah. So he must have been involved in some other capacity. But we've not been able to ask him any questions at all. He's just disappeared. And, of course, the Russians just say, this is actually an attempt to blacken our name.
Martin, the Skripals have disappeared too, haven't they?
They have. And, of course, in actual fact, it's come out that Skripal initially didn't believe that the Russians had attacked him at all. That's in Luke Harding's book. And Luke Harding, of course, who works for The Guardian, and Martin Chulov, they have very, very good contacts with MI6. If you're going to be an intelligence journalist, it's one of the things you've got to do. You've got to have a very, very good contact with these people, and they, of course, then say, "You do know so and so and so and so."
And
don't
if you start
you?
Asking any
that,
sorts
you can
of
make a very, very profitable career.
If you start asking any sorts of awkward questions, suddenly all your contacts at MI6 dry up.
That's right. And in other words, there's a whole career involved in this, which involves being chummy with them. And being chummy with them means just recycling what you want them to. They want you to say. So, for example, in the Daily Telegraph many years ago now, there was a story about how the Bosnians had blown up their own bread queue in order to discredit Serbia, because at that stage the British policy was not to intervene. Nobody in Yugoslavia believed it, but it was in the Daily Telegraph and the source was probably MI6. Well, that's what they do. They go to their friends in the media, and the UFO, whatever his name is in
you mean Udolf Ukotti?
Yeah, he just said, everybody in the German media works for the CIA. They basically send them stuff, which is CIA stuff, and then they put it out under their name, and that is paid for by your taxes, folks, but that is just basically manipulating your
mind. Let's have a look at the people who were running this operation down in Salisbury, that is to say the anti-terrorist police from London who took over from the local police. The Skripal's cat was shot dead and their guinea pigs were left to dehydrate and die in agony.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to get too upset about that. These are minor matters. The really serious matter is, why does an anti-terrorist squad from London immediately take over what is a local investigation? And the answer to that is pretty clear.
Because they've got all the expertise.
Well, partly, but also I would argue in the long run, there's very strong evidence that British intelligence services and senior anti-terrorist police officers are implicated in a lot of this stuff. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group is based in Manchester because it was put there by MI6 in the 1980s.
Yeah, but that's MI6. That's not the anti-terrorist police.
That's why they're there.
Martin, these are the people who've gained all this experience through the 7/7 attacks, the Manchester bombing, etc.
I'm not hostile necessarily to the civilian police force, but I don't necessarily trust them either. Don't forget that the Met Anti-Terrorist Squad, the so-called experts, are the ones who are going to work most closely with MI6 and MI5, whereas the Wiltshire police might have taken a more independent view, and they've got their own CID who could easily have started the investigation, and they should have been left. I would argue in the future, because of the suspicions we have about the terrorist attacks being inside the structure, it should be running exactly that way.
Also, Charlie Rowley has gone blind. This is the guy from the Amesbury attack much more recently. And Dawn Sturgis has died. Her brother, though, and other family members worked at Boscombe Down, the top secret RAF flying base, test flying base, just near Porton Down and very close to Salisbury.
Well, we just don't know exactly what's happened here. I would say that, if, as the Russians have pointed out, if this was nerve agent, they'd all be dead, and possibly half of Salisbury as well. So clearly not a nerve agent being used. Just a basic logical point. Now, Porton Down said it was Novichok, whatever Novichok is. Now, in actual fact, people are being bamboozled here, and you don't take much to work out what's happening.
Nothing much has been made of Charlie Rowley and Dawn Sturgis's alleged heroin addiction, which is extraordinary, because they could have died simply of fentanyl poisoning, which is this kind of highly powerful form of synthetic heroin. And there was actually a warning out about that stuff hanging around in Wiltshire just a couple of weeks before they were succumbed to what was supposed to be a Novichok attack.
Now, it's possible that Skripal was actually involved in some kind of sting operation on the Russians. It's possible that that Charlie Rowley and the other woman were either complete patsies, and of course being sort of rubbish people, heroin addicts, they could easily be killed. The state wouldn't do things like that. The state does do things like that. It's been doing it for years. We've got to see all of this stuff in the context of what Western intelligence services have been proved to have done over decades. Engage in provocation.
I can reveal something exclusively tonight, which is that the Wiltshire coroner's officer, one of them, just literally 2 days after this alleged attack, said, "Oh, Sergei and Juliet will die. We've got our body bags ready. We're ready for them, because there's no way they can survive this." That's the coroner's office in Wiltshire itself.
Well, in actual fact, they did, didn't they? And the other thing, of course, is that
they didn't die.
No, I know. A doctor at the Salisbury Hospital wrote a letter to the Times where he said there is no nerve agent. We treated three cases of poisoning, and he didn't say poisoning from nerve agent, he just said poisoning, and nobody else was affected. So in other words, we've got somebody from inside the hospital saying actually this is all a load of nonsense, and I've forgotten the name of it, but it was a letter in the Times that they wrote, ignored by most of the mainstream media, but there it is. Somebody has said, in actual fact, we didn't treat anybody for nerve agent.
So anyway, I find it fascinating when someone like Julian Assange comes along, a super radical publisher that is criticising our intelligence services doing exactly what the London media should be doing but aren't. There's been a very strange turnaround, hasn't there, Martin, in the way that The Guardian have been dealing with him, because to begin with, he was a fantastic source, they were supporting him in every single way. Suddenly, The Guardian took against him, and now he's a persona non grata in that newspaper. Why is that?
Well, they basically engaged in trying to create a false opposition. So the Guardian wants to be seen as kind of radical liberal and therefore opposed to Putin and Trump and so on. And so they need to get some credibility in that kind of liberal mindset. But once they've got that credibility, they can then start feeding the lies that the intelligence services want those liberal-minded people to believe. And I'm afraid that Luke Harding and Martin Chulov, who are their main kind of experts, so supposedly on all of this stuff, are deeply in cahoots with the intelligence services. Now, I don't think they'd even deny it.
If Elliot Higgins was a kind of Julian Assange, he would have been publishing what WikiLeaks have today, and that is, I think it's today actually, is it yesterday? Yeah, sorry, it was actually on Wednesday. WikiLeaks published a highly confidential Amazon document, which they say the document lists the addresses and some operational details over 100 data centres spread across 15 cities in 9 countries. It comes with the top line notice warning. This information is not published and is public and is classed as highly confidential. The WikiLeaks say Amazon is notoriously secretive about the locations of its data centres. While a few are publicly tied to Amazon, this is the exception rather than the norm. More often, Amazon operates out of data centres owned by other companies, with little indication that Amazon is even involved with them. And so WikiLeaks have published this Amazon Atlas, they call it, the highly confidential locations of Amazon's data centres. Actually, of course, Amazon are part of the Western elite. They are a sort of massive transnational company, which is very, very much in with the powerful governments in the West. And so it's not really surprising, I suppose, that Bellingcat isn't really interested in leaking this kind of material. Julian Assange, by the way, has been put in a rather difficult situation in London, hasn't he? Even though he's actually not any longer wanted in Sweden, he's been told by the British by the British police that if he leaves the embassy, you'll be arrested anyway.
Which is extraordinary if you think about it, because for months and months and months he was being told that he's got to answer these charges in Sweden, which wasn't exactly true, but they've all been dropped. But even so, he's going to be arrested on the basis of what, you have to ask yourself, charged with what. And they're going to extradite him to the US. His situation's particularly deteriorated since the election in Ecuador. The left won the election, so Rafael Correa had his two terms as president, and he's still very supportive of Assange. But Lenin Moreno, despite his name, is more of a moderate, if you like, and more willing to bow to US pressure. And he is leaning on Assange to give himself up by cutting off his email and so on. But Correa, who was the former president of Ecuador, is not very happy about that at all. And I'm afraid it's very difficult in this world to stand up to the powerful, because they fight back.
They don't just sit
on their hands.
Is Elliot Higgins going to be making a series of disclosures about alleged CIA hacking tools, as WikiLeaks was? It was dogged by accusations from the US of being fed stolen data from Russian intelligence.
Well, it's not from Russian intelligence, is it? We've already established the DNC hack was definitely not from Russian intelligence, although that Elliot Higgins seems to believe that it was, although all the evidence is otherwise. But, of course, it's now become a bien pensant opinion, is now that the Russians are somehow trying to... they hacked into the DNC emails, and that's what led to the discrediting of US democracy. It does discredit US democracy because it shows it's all rigged, but it wasn't rigged by the Russians, was it? It was rigged by our own intelligence services. So in actual fact, what they're doing is pot calling kettle black. They're accusing the Russians of doing what they are doing. They are rigging our elections and accusing the Russians of doing it to cover their tracks. And that's the reality.
Poor old Julian Assange, though. I mean, I do feel terribly sorry for the guy. He's now being accused of being a massive election fixer, and they're saying that if he comes out of the embassy, he'll be arrested. I mean, that just doesn't seem right for somebody who's a publisher like he is.
Well, it's based on this whole DNC leak. Now, in actual fact, even if the Russians had hacked the DNC emails, and nobody disputes that what the emails show is that the primaries in the US were rigged against Bernie Sanders. That's what they show. Nobody disputes that on any side. And, of course, what the CIA are complaining is, well, this shows up American democracy in a bad light, therefore it must be Russian subversion. Now, in actual fact, it doesn't show any such things. It shows American democracy up in a bad light, because American democracy deserves to be shown up in a bad light. And even if the Russians had hacked it, it still wouldn't mean that WikiLeaks, who got hold of it, should be prosecuted for putting out information which everybody agrees to be true, that the DNC primaries were rigged. And this is quite significant politically, because if Bernie Sanders had been the candidate against Trump, all the opinion polls showed that he might well have won. So instead of sitting here talking about what Trump's going to do next, we'll be talking about what's Bernie Sanders going to do next. And that's where we're not, because things are rigged, but not by the Russians, rigged by our own secret services.
The Washington Post are saying about Assange that he faces deepening isolation as his asylum at Ecuadorian embassy in London is into its seventh year. The new president of Ecuador is showing exasperation with Assange's presence, and the embassy has restricted his internet access and other privileges. Though Sweden has long since dropped its original arrest warrant for Assange on rape and sexual assault allegations, the British police are keen to take him into custody for evading a warrant of their own. Assange's supporters must face the possibility that their old idol could soon find himself in a British jail.
Are you asking me about this? Well, he could soon find himself in a US jail. Of course, US senators have said he should be assassinated. Is that incitement? If a senator says this guy should be assassinated? Should the senator be sent to prison? Now, what's underlying all of this? And I'll come back and repeat it yet again.
No, you're not going to repeat it yet again. I just wanted to point out that Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller III and has been one of the key people providing evidence that could put Assange in jail.
For doing what? Now,
who is this guy?
Well, he's an FBI insider, and of course he was involved in the Stop Trump campaign, which Skripal was also involved in via Christopher Steele and Pablo Miller, who are ex-MI6 agents, if such things exist, who live in Salisbury. And they came up with the whole pee dossier about Trump paying prostitutes to pee on Obama's bed, the bed he'd slept in when he was in Moscow.
You mean Trump?
Trump. No, but Obama's bed that Obama had slept in, Trump paid the prostitutes to pee on the bed, apparently. Okay. You remember all this stuff? Yeah? That's what we're supposed to take seriously, folks.
And what's the connection between that and Skripal then?
Because Skripal was the source of all the scuttlebutt that was in that report, which was used to try and discredit...
What do you mean by scuttlebutt? I mean, the scuttlebutt, did you just make it up?
Yeah, well, yes, basically made it up. I mean, they were given a... they were paid to come up with stuff on Trump, and MI6 officers Christopher Steele and Pablo Miller, who were Skripal's handlers, came up with all this stuff to discredit Trump for money, because they're ex-MI6 officers now. They're working on their own account, and that's what possibly is behind all of this stuff in Salisbury. Nothing to do with the Russians at all, just nasty stuff in the US.
Well, while we're talking about the I suppose the British military in one way or another, the army this week has been investigating a Tommy Robinson photo with a load of soldiers. The army's investigating after former English Defence League founder and leader Tommy Robinson posted a photo of himself with a group of young soldiers. Mr. Robinson also put a video of the scene on Facebook in which the men could be heard cheering and shouting his name. The army said it was aware of the posts and investigating the circumstances. A spokeswoman said far-right ideology is at odds with the values and ethos of the armed forces. She added, "The armed forces have robust measures in place to ensure those exhibiting extremist views are neither tolerated nor permitted to serve." So does that mean every single face in that photo, Martin, is going to be kicked out of the army?
Well, apparently somebody already has, but the rest of them haven't. And of course, if you're going to go and fight in Afghanistan, it's not really very good for your war fighting capacity for the Taliban to be able to see you cheering and shouting for Tommy Robinson. They're going to say, right, well, when you come to our manor, this isn't England, this is Afghanistan, and you are friendly with these far right loonies. We're going to blow your head off, son. We're going to make your parents cry, make your children cry, because this is warfare.
Now,
not
some,
for the faint
some people
hearted.
Are saying that this UK soldier who was been discharged has been discharged to make the Muslim community happy. Former British paratrooper said Tommy Robinson has more support in the British Army than Theresa May. British anti-Muslim takeover activist Tommy Robinson recently stopped at a service station where four buses full of British soldiers were taking a break. After saying hello to the soldiers, some of them posed for selfie photographs with him, who called the occasion an honour to stand with British troops and shake their hands, even just for a few moments.
Yeah, well, what I would say is, if I was a senior British soldier officer, I'd say, you're going to lose us the war in Afghanistan. We're in Afghanistan to try and impose our will on them, and you're being friendly with Tommy Robinson, and that's going to go all around the world. That means any attempt we're trying to make to get these people on side to support us is going to fail, which is why you shouldn't be doing it, even if you think it. And of course, if you think it, maybe you shouldn't be in the army at all. Maybe you should be doing something else.
Also, there's another story relating to this. A senior UKIP figure slams Tommy Robinson and the British soldiers. That is, former UKIP leadership candidate Ben Walker claimed that the brave soldiers were just civilians and not soldiers. Walker, 39, is a member of the UKIP National Executive Committee, as it was allegedly part of a dodgy backroom deal by the NEC to crush plans to let members decide if Tommy could join the party in August. So obviously Ben Walker, who's been on this programme, he's actually from Bristol, isn't he, has been making sure that to block attempts for Tommy Robinson to join UKIP.
Well, I think this is a problem for the right wing in this country to decide. Either they're either for or against the Tommy Robinson approach to the world. Now, what I suspect is that both the English Defence League and Al-Majharoon appeared simultaneously in Luton, where Robinson, or of course his name isn't Robinson, it's Lennox something or other, came from. I think that in actual fact that what we're looking at here is manipulation by what we were talking about earlier, our own intelligence services, the people that put the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group into Manchester in the 1980s. And they've got intimate links with our intelligence services. And these silly soldiers who think that Tommy Robinson is on their side, Tommy Robinson is working with the intelligence services and working with the Islamic extremists. And of course, if you're a soldier and you're involved in this kind of thing, don't forget you're going to Muslim countries, and your anti-Muslim views, your face is out there, yeah? You have been identified as somebody with extreme anti-Muslim views, and then you're going to be posted to a Muslim country where all these people are going to have a look at you and say, yeah, you,
actually,
what are you doing?
In The Guardian, I think it was yesterday, Joe Glenton...
Joe Glenton's article was good.
He was saying that actually there is a loads of far-right views within the British Army and amongst the soldiers.
Well, we know that the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, according to the Garda Síochána, the Irish police, were carried out by MI5. And we also know that the British British Army Force Research
Unit.
It wasn't
British Army soldiers, Martin, was it?
No, but they're part of a structure, Tony. They're all supposed to be on the same side. And, of course, the Army Force Research Unit, the Ulster Defence...
His actual headline, if you can stick to the topic, is the Tommy Robinson photos show how far right the British Army is. There are good reasons why infantrymen were excited to see Britain's most notorious bigot, says the former soldier... Joe Glenton, he starts the article by saying the truth about the relationship between some smiling young infantryman, one of whom it's reported will be discharged from the army, and far-right patriot, in big inverted commas, Tommy Robinson, is unknown. And as a former defence journalist, versed in Ministry of Defence spin, I predict that when the military gives its account of the facts, it will be no clearer. Yet serious concerns have emerged again and again about links between the military and the far-right.
Indeed, there was an attempted military coup in this country in the 1970s to get rid of Harold Wilson. The British Army is potentially a real problem, and I'm not saying it should be completely got rid of, but a lot of people in it should be, basically sacked. They shouldn't be in that job. It's like being a police officer and being a racist. They're not the same thing.
The links to the
far right.
This is another Guardian article from earlier this year in April. A Nazi salute British officer was cleared of a terrorism offence. Corporal Mikko Vehivalen was found not guilty over the Breivik manifesto and admitting having CS gas. So that's a little bit concerning. And also a neo-Nazi managed to join the British Army despite declaring support for National Action Online. We also know, don't we, I mean, it's not just the British Army and the German Army. We had that German officer arrested for attempting to plant a bomb at Vienna Airport and blame it on a Muslim or Syrian immigrants.
Yeah, and that's not just random people doing random stuff. They're actually working with the intelligence services. Now, I'm not actually completely hostile to the British Army. I used to have to cooperate with them when I was in Bosnia. But the fact of the matter is, if you've got extreme right-wing views, you're a danger to yourself and to the missions that the army is going to be undertaking. I don't think the British Army should be in Afghanistan, but if you're going to go to Afghanistan, you can't turn up with anti-Muslim views, because you're definitely going to lose the battle, aren't you?
The British Army came up at Prime Minister's questions as well, Martin, so let's have a listen to that now.
James Gray.
Mr. Speaker, the 120 soldiers who will march into the north door of Westminster Hall straight after PMQs are actually representing the 3,000 who are currently deployed in 28 different countries around the world. And I'm delighted the Prime Minister, and I hope colleagues from across the House and staff from around the palace will be there to welcome them and to thank them for all they do. But will they also at that time remember two lots of people? First, the families without whose support their deployment would not be possible. Second, those who are returning from overseas injured both mentally and physically. And thirdly, those comrades who will never return.
Yeah. Well, can I say to my honourable friend that he puts his point extremely well. Of course, we are proud of everything that our servicemen and women do, and we will be pleased, I and other members of this House will be pleased to welcome those servicemen and women and to give that thanks and to them in the way that we can here in this House. But he is absolutely right. We should never forget the families who of those servicemen and women, and we should ensure that we are supporting those families. We should also recognise the importance of supporting those who do return with injuries, some of those injuries of course physical and some mental, and ensuring that we recognise both physical and mental injuries is important, and we should never forget those who have laid down their lives for our freedom and for our security.
Well, as I said before, I'm not entirely hostile to the British Army, but on the other hand, there's an awful lot of mawkishness about all of this. What about all the millions of children that have been killed in the wars of the last 15 years, started by our government? We invaded Afghanistan and Iraq on completely false pretenses. We're still there. We got kicked out of Basra. The local boys kicked our boys out. And they couldn't do anything about it, because they're the ones who stood up to Saddam Hussein for donkey's years, and we turned up and brutalised them, and then they drove us out because they've got more bottle than we have, and it's their country at the end of the day.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
There's another one, Martin. This is a chap called Jamal Khashoggi, and he was writing up until last Tuesday for the Washington Post, and he's a former insider in Saudi Arabia. He's now disappeared in the consulate in Istanbul.
Well, unlike Skripal, he's probably dead. And what the Turks are suggesting is that he was tortured before he was killed. Now, I don't know if that's true, but it's certainly a big political story, because they're our closest allies. Are we going to cut off aid and trade to them? Sanctions on Russia for Skripal? What about sanctions on Saudi Arabia?
But surely if someone wanders into the Saudi embassy, they Saudis are entitled, as it's their territory, to do what they want with them, especially if they believe he's a criminal and deserves a death sentence.
Well, he's not a criminal. He's somebody that's a dissident. He's actually not a very strong dissident. He's a mild critic. But, of course, what they're trying to do is intimidate everybody else in Saudi Arabia to understand you're going to be disappeared, basically, if you speak out. And, there were loads of diplomats expelled after the Skripal affair, wasn't there? Hundreds of diplomats from all over the world. Do you think any Saudi diplomats are going to be expelled about this? What do you think? They're our allies. Of course not.
What the Turks are saying, Martin, is that they were bugging that embassy and that they've got audio recordings of poor old Kamal Khashoggi being tortured and then murdered.
Yeah, and the Turks and the Saudis, although they have a fairly fraught relationship, were on the same side in Syria for nearly 5 years. So when they say it, it doesn't do them any favours. Yeah, they need to be talking to the Saudis. And if even the Turks are saying he was chopped up and murdered, I think we can presume that he was chopped up and murdered. And I put it again, when are we going to expel Saudi diplomats and impose sanctions?
Well, I'll tell you
which is what we did on Russia.
The person that you need to ask that question to is Donald Trump. We're going to hear a bit of Trump's reaction to this apparent murder. I mean, it almost looks 100% certain now that the journalist was murdered for his views by the Saudi Arabian government. I suppose by the monarchy there, really. And so it was Press TV that interviewed someone about this, and I'll tell you who they were in a second. But anyway, we really want to hear from Donald Trump.
According to the Washington Post, the recordings show that a Saudi security team detained Khashoggi in the consulate and after he entered there on October 2nd. The report said the security team killed the journalist and dismembered his body after torturing him. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump ruled out the possibility of stopping Hurst Hills in Saudi Arabia following Khashoggi's disappearance.
I would not be in favor of stopping a country from spending $110 billion, which is an all-time record, and letting Russia have that money and letting China have that money, because all they're going to do is say, that's okay, we don't have to buy it from Boeing, we don't have to buy it from Lockheed, we don't have to buy it from Raytheon and all these great companies, we'll buy it from Russia. We'll buy it from China. So what good does that do us? There are other things we can do.
Well, it's pretty clear what's going on here. There's the military-industrial complex that likes selling expensive kit to Saudi government. Of course, doesn't represent the Saudi people. Saudi taxpayers are paying for it. It's putting money in Donald Trump's pocket. It's putting money in lots of people's. So if somebody's been murdered, it's the cost of doing business, isn't it? When it comes to Skripal, of course, it's got to be expelling diplomats.
Skripal wasn't murdered.
Oh, but there was an attempt to murder him, apparently, although that's actually debatable, isn't it? But in this case, this guy's been chopped up and is definitely dead as far as we can see. But of course, nothing's going to happen about this because, it's just a different kind of case, isn't it?
We need the oil. We just need the oil.
It's not just oil. There's all sorts of things involved in this. Fundamentally, it's to do with the military-industrial complex and with imperialism. The British Army goes all over the world. We were talking about it earlier. And is the Russian Army trying to occupy Britain? No, they're not. But we're trying to occupy Afghanistan. We tried to occupy Iraq. And as I said earlier, we got kicked out of Basra because the Mehdi army, who were the local boys, weren't going to put up with it.
Okay, the latest anyway is that the Turks are saying you can hear his voice and the voices of men speaking Arabic. One person with knowledge of the recordings told the Washington Post, you can hear how he was interrogated, tortured and then murdered. The voice recording from inside the embassy lays out what happened to Jamal after he entered. The Post source added, while a second official told the newspaper that Khashoggi could be heard on the recording undergoing beatings from his captors.
Well, are we surprised about this?
I mean, you could say the same about this, that this all could be made up, that this voice recording maybe doesn't exist.
Well, I suspend judgment, but as I said to you earlier...
Why haven't the Turks actually released the recording?
Well, until they do, we're left in the situation where we don't actually know what's happened. So let's not jump to conclusions. But he's definitely disappeared, hasn't he? He's not, his fiancée was waiting for him outside the embassy and he didn't come out. Yeah, so he's gone somewhere. It's a bit like the disappearances in Latin America. You never know exactly where the people have gone, but you can be pretty certain that they're dead or that they're in some kind of horrible prison. Because, of course, we've got all these secret prisons all over the world now, run in total defiance of Magna Carta by our people and the Americans and the Israelis.
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, we're now going to look at Nikki Haley. What's your own thoughts about why she's resigned?
Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? You'd have to ask her. But I think she's being groomed to be a presidential candidate, can you believe? And therefore, she needs to establish some distance between her and Trump. And in actual fact, she's more hard-line than Trump on various issues. So it may be that her more hard-line view and his more kind of
idiosyncratic... She's been pushing back against Trump, do you think?
She was coming out with stuff which Trump hadn't agreed with. And I think that Trump's lost virtually everybody around him.
US organisation Human Rights Watch has marked her passing from the United Nations by condemning Nikki Haley's human rights record. And let's have a little listen now to another clip from Press TV, where we also hear the voice of former psychological warfare officer in the US Army, Scott Bennett.
Quote, she's leaving behind a disappointing legacy of human rights. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a mild description of her fingernails being dragged down a chalkboard voice in history she's left the world reeling in pain over. I think calling her anything than a hypocrite is a gesture of kindness. Nikki Haley really has been one of the worst manifestations of a political voice in a diplomatic position, because she's symbolized the opposite of diplomacy. She has not been persuasive or charming. She perhaps looked in the mirror and charmed herself, but when she looked into the faces of diplomats around the world, she came across them as a warmongering savage that was full of contradictions and hypocrisies. You have Syria that has been destroyed essentially because of the United States' complicity with Saudi Arabia and Israel sending mercenaries into destroying President Bashar Assad's government. You have the United States in Libya, which allowed Sarkozy and Cameron and the NATO forces to destabilize Libya and set up a whole human refugee invasion of Europe. You have Russia, you have Iran. Nikki Haley has constantly been condemning Russia and Iran with false accusations. And of course, Israel is her number one idol that she bows to in this worshiping delusional mantra that any organization and any person that says or criticizes Israel for its human rights abuses and its apartheid and its genocide is somehow an enemy of human rights, somehow is an enemy of democracy. So I don't think anyone will miss Nikki Haley.
Yeah, well, I understand that there is talk of her being the Israeli lobby in the US are talking about running her for president. But that may be one of the reasons why she's resigned, to clear the way for her to do that. Pretty frightening if it's the case, but there you are.
Who might replace her then?
Well, I don't know. There'll be a whole load of minor people we've never heard of who will fulfil that role. The UN, the US ambassador to NATO, called for a first strike on Russian missiles in Europe last week as well. I've forgotten her name, but I mean, she was just saying, well, if the Russians don't back down here, we're going to do a first strike on their missiles. It's like nobody said anything. I mean, the Russians have said, well, nobody's talked like that to us since 1945. What do you mean you're going to do a first strike on our missiles? But they haven't resigned. They're still there.
So Israel's mentioned there. Of course, Nikki Haley's a big defender of Israel, and despite their appalling human rights record of the Israeli army snipers killing something like 170 unarmed demonstrators, deliberately murdering them, with the army fighting, seemingly preferring to fight defenseless civilians rather than to take on the Syrian Arab army, for example, in the Golan Heights. But we've also seen a fascinating article this week, Martin, which is one of the first on this subject for a while, very comprehensive, by a chap called Ron Unz. The case that 9/11 was an Israeli attack on the United States is overwhelmingly strong. Just a quote from it, he says, the attacks must have been the work of a highly sophisticated organisation with access to advanced military technology. And then once we have concluded that the culprits were part of a highly sophisticated organisation, we can focus on the who and the why, which surely would be of greater importance than the particular details of the how. So what do you make of this article? I'm assuming that you've read it.
I did read it. And, Rollins self-identifies as a conservative. So therefore,
he's also Jewish, isn't he?
Yeah. And so therefore, when he says that, I think he's a Jewish conservative in the United States, I think. And when he says, I think this is an inside job, probably by the Israelis, then you've got to take it with some seriousness. But of course, the evidence that it was an inside job is overwhelming, as we've covered on this program many times over the years. And of course, that then brings things like Skripal and all the rest of it into focus. They're quite prepared to kill 3,500 people in order to start a war with in the Middle East, and that's the sort of people they are. And therefore, when they come out and say, well, Bellingcat says and Bellingcat says that, I just say, well, hang on, Bellingcat, do you know about Gladio? Do you know about Operation Beluga?
Let me just quote a bit from this article. Many believed, he said, that the violence in the Middle East might trigger a huge outflow of Israeli citizens, perhaps producing a death spiral for the Jewish state. Iraq, Iran, Libya and other major Muslim powers were supporting the Palestinians with money, rhetoric and sometimes weaponry, and Israeli society seemed close to crumbling. I remember, he says, hearing from some of my DC friends that numerous Israeli policy experts were suddenly seeking berths at neocon think tanks so they could relocate to America. Sharon, who was the prime minister or president at the time, was a notoriously bloody and reckless leader with a long history of undertaking strategic gambles and astonishing boldness, sometimes betting everything on a single roll of the dice. He had spent decades seeking the prime ministership, but having finally obtained it, he now had his back to the wall with no obvious source of rescue in sight. 9/11 changed everything. Suddenly, the world's sole superpower was fully mobilised against Arab and Muslim terrorist movements, especially those connected with the Middle East. Sharon's close neocon political allies in America used the unexpected crisis as an opportunity to seize control of America's foreign policy and national security apparatus, with an NSA staffer later reporting that Israeli generals freely roamed the halls of the Pentagon with no security control.
Well, that's right. I mean, my own assessment is that the Mossad were definitely involved, but so were the CIA and MI6. And in actual fact, they're all three arms of the same structure. And there's not really much to choose between them.
He also says certainly no other nation in the world other than Israel can remotely match the track record of remarkably bold, high-level assassinations and false flag attacks, terrorist and otherwise, against other countries, even including America and its military. Furthermore, the enormous dominance of Jewish and pro-Israel elements in the American establishment media, and increasingly that of many other major countries in the West, has long ensured, even when the solid evidence of such attacks was discovered, very few ordinary Americans would ever hear them.
Well, the USS Liberty in 1967 was attacked by the Israeli Air Force as a false flag attack, because they hoped that the Americans would presume that it was the Egyptians who'd carried out the attack and that they would join in the war and attack Egypt. They killed 30-odd sailors on that ship, and they got away with it.
Even though it was a BBC
Two documentary about it.
Okay, let's just look at the right at the very beginning of the Israeli state, Martin. Yeah. The military and terrorist attacks were even more striking, he says. One of the history's largest terrorist attacks prior to 9/11 was the 1946 bombing of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem by Zionist militants, and they dressed as Arabs. They killed 91 people and largely destroyed the entire structure. The Lavon affair of 1954, Israeli agents launched a wave of terrorist attacks against Western targets in Egypt, intending to have those blamed on anti-Western Arab groups. So this is basically part of the DNA, it seems, in the Israeli government.
That's right. And it's and that's the sort of thing that really goes on, folks. The Lavon affair in the 1950s, Israeli agents were going around blowing up Western targets in Egypt, pretending to be Arab extremists. That was in 1954. That's a long time ago. Do you think they've changed their spots? The answer is no. They've got more sophisticated, they spend more money on it, but the basic tactics have remained the same.
The enormous extent, he says, of pro-Israel influence in world political and media circles means none of these brutal attacks ever draw serious retaliation, and in nearly all cases they were quickly thrown down the memory hole, so that today probably no more than 1 in 100 Americans is even aware of them. A lot of this is about keeping people stupid.
Well, it's basically because people have only got a certain amount of time to take in information, and if that time's taken up with lots of rubbish and trivia, and then maybe they've got 20-25 minutes a day to take in serious stuff, and then that serious stuff is disinformation, then they really don't know what's going on. Western intelligence services are known terrorists. Anybody who knows anything knows that, but lots of people don't know anything.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Finally, to the east of Ukraine, let's have a listen to Manfred Petrish now. And he starts really by talking about the assassination of the leader of the Donbass.
The reason why in Western media there's not much report about it, because this assassination through a bomb was planned by the CIA and MI6, and they executed this murder of the head of this Eastern Separatist region. He walked into his favorite coffee shop, and when he would open the door, the bomb exploded. And the type of bomb that was exploded, because it exploded above his head, is typical for this CIA method. And this is what happened. And by killing him, of course, he was a close ally to the Russians. And anything that damages and the Russians, of course, is done, whatever it is, right?
Actually, there's a simmering conflict, isn't there, going on in the east of Ukraine. I wonder whether you think that may be actually, you know, more worthy of more attention.
It looks like they will try to put petrol into this fire to make it bigger by supplying the Ukrainians with a lot of new weapons. They're sending a lot of new weapons into Ukraine, and they're training the Ukrainians for war. So it looks like the NATO countries, and especially America, wants to ignite a conflict or make the conflict that exists much bigger, to provoke Russia. And this is absolutely potentially happening, that after the Syrian war is actually simmering down, and the last stronghold of the terrorists in Idlib, it looks like it's going to be taken soon, that they will move their focus over to Ukraine and start something there again.
What is the motive for all of this? Surely nobody wants war, do they?
Don't forget that the Western economy, and especially the American economy, is a war economy, and they always have to have a war somewhere so that the armament industry is running at its producing weapons and bombs and everything. So they always need a conflict somewhere. That the last thing that they need and want is peace, because peace is not good for business. Wars are good for business, and that's why they have to have a conflict everywhere somewhere, and so that weapons and bombs and munition is used. So and the American industry, the American economy runs on wars. It's always.
But it's a different type of conflict if the Americans and the British are starting now to take on Putin. They've taken on people like Saddam, Gaddafi, Assad, who are fairly small in comparison to Putin. I mean, surely there's no way that the NATO can really take on Moscow, take on Russia, take on Putin and win.
Of course not. I mean, the NATO compared to Russia military is like a Boy Scout club. I mean, you can't compare the two from a weapon capability point of view. Russia has nearly 40,000 tanks, which can start rolling into the West. I mean, look at what Germany has. Germany has less than 100 tanks which are operational. They have one U-boat that works. They have only about 90 aircraft that actually fly. So it's a joke, yeah? But it's not about a war with Russia, which is, of course, self-destruction. It's about keeping a conflict always simmering, so there is always something happening, right? And that they can justify their military expenditure. That's the whole point. Don't forget, Russia is just so huge. It is actually not a country. Russia is a continent. It's so huge. It spans half the planet, right? Half the planet is Russia, and in the northern hemisphere. It has 8 time zones, right? So you can imagine how big it is. And what has always been the lust of the West is to gain access to the resources, to the metals, to the oil, to the gas, to all the all these resources that Russia has. And that's what they always wanted to gain, right? And also it has to do that the unipolar world, and Russia is the one that says, no, we must have a multipolar world. We cannot have one empire that rules the world. They don't accept that, right? Putin, because of his obvious weakness not to counter all these aggression, has a weak, as is getting weaker and weaker in his standing in Russia. And the Russian military is actually now telling him what to do, because you see it regarding Syria and the delivery of the S-300 anti-aircraft system. See, Putin always listened to Netanyahu, to his friend Netanyahu, who told him not to deliver the S-300 to Syria. And he was the guy who blocked everything. But now, after the shooting down of the Russian plane with 15 dead soldiers, the military has now told Putin to step aside. And it was the defense minister, Shogun, who has decided to deliver the S-300 to Syria. And so Putin, has, if he continues this appeasement policy, I can imagine that he will lose his job. He will lose his job in Russia, because if you look at all the Russian television programs and the discussions there, they are all criticizing Putin because of he's not standing the ground or not doing anything against all this Western aggression. I think if you look at the last few weeks, you see all the time the defense minister in front of the cameras, and he is calling the shots, definitely. And he looks like, a very strong man who knows what he's doing. He was the guy who said to Putin, we will now deliver the S-300 to Syria, which is, of course, a huge step there that the Syrian Syrians can then defend against any more attacks coming from Israel and also from the other NATO countries.
That's Manfred Petrich from All Smoke and Mirrors. I put a full version of that up on our show page on the podcast. You can download from there at thisweek.org.uk. Your thoughts very briefly, Martin.
Well, the murder of Zakharchenko, of course, they could easily say, well, we should retaliate. But of course, if they retaliate, they're terrorists. So they've just got to suck it up. But of course, the British Army may have been involved in that. I suspect their hand in this as well.
No news at 8 o'clock, I'm afraid. Hopefully that'll be back next week, but it's time to sign off now. But no Murdoch news at 8 o'clock. Coming up, Arabian Nights, hopefully, with Mohammed Makawi. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend with Billy Quain, Saturday edition at 10 a.m. and The Real Musical Deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. Are there any humans?